Hello and welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly review of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main issue. I'm Oksana Smirichuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the stories that were in the news this week.
As I made clear at my Senate confirmation hearing, the United States will consider working with Russia when we can find areas of practical cooperation that will benefit the American people. Where we do not see eye to eye, the United States will stand up for the interests and values of America and her allies. As we search for new common ground, we expect Russia to honor its commitment to the Minsk agreements and work to de-escalate the violence in the Ukraine.
At first glance, the security situation in Donetsk and Luhansk region has improved. Following the flare-up in Avdiivka and Yasinovata, we saw last week a decrease in the number of ceasefire violations. Dear friends, the fact remains, however, that the full and comprehensive cessation of fire has not been achieved yet.
Мы свои территории не возвращаем. Крым является территорией Российской Федерации. Все.
У засіданні Верховної Ради України беруть участь прем'єр-міністр України Володимир Борисович Гройсман та члени уряду. Привітаємо наш уряд.
The United States and Russia continue to clash over Crimea. Ukraine and Crimea continue to come up in US-Russia relations. The first high-level meeting since Trump became president happened this week in Germany on Thursday during the G20 summit. US State Secretary Rex Tillerson met Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Bonn. The two were smiling and shaking hands for the photo op. Afterwards, Tillerson told reporters that while the US will consider working with Russia, it also expects Russia to abide by the Minsk agreements and work to de-escalate the violence in Ukraine. Earlier in the week, White House spokesman Sean Spicer had said that Trump was taking a tougher line with Russia and expected Moscow to withdraw from Crimea. Russia responded by saying, "Crimea is part of the Russian Federation. We are not returning our territory." Ukraine's parliament reconvened last week, and a group of MPs sent an open letter to their colleagues in what they called the free world. They appealed to the world's parliaments to call upon Russia to fulfill their international obligations regarding Ukraine. The letter states, "We are forced to state that Russia, as the aggressor country, continues to further escalate the conflict in the occupied parts of Donetsk and Luhansk regions. This is proven by a critical situation which has emerged during the past days and which is turning into a humanitarian disaster as a result of systematic attacks by illegal armed groups near the town of Avdiivka in the Donetsk region." Meanwhile, in Crimea, journalist Mykola Semena is facing a court date on February the 17th. Last year, Ukraine Calling reported that he was charged with separatism for his reporting. The charge carries a sentence of up to 5 years imprisonment. Semena issued a statement this week. He explains that he is a Ukrainian citizen, whereas in all the documents related to his case, he is listed as a citizen of Russia. After Russia annexed Crimea, it imposed Russian citizenship on all residents of the peninsula. Some, like Semena, have resisted. Also this week, Aisha Setmuratova celebrated her 80th birthday. She's a well-known Crimean Tatar legend, a former dissident, a human rights activist, historian, and an elder of the Crimean Tatar national movement. Her friends threw her a party in Bakhchisarai, Crimea, which was once the capital of the Crimean Tatar Khanate. They enjoyed their traditional food and music, and Aisha herself danced with most of the guests. We'll be posting a video of the event on our website. Ukraine's Prime Minister Groysman is confident that the next IMF loan tranche will be released to Ukraine by the end of the month. He was in Brussels last week, meeting with EU and NATO officials and made positive statements about Ukraine and the IMF. The country's finance minister, Oleksandr Danilyuk, was also giving interviews, saying that negotiations are in the final stages. The challenging issues are pension reform, judicial reform, and fighting the deficit. Ukraine, like all post-Soviet states, has unrealistically low official retirement ages. and this causes severe strain on the budget. However, raising the retirement age is an extremely sensitive issue in any country, not only Ukraine. PM Groysman said that although Ukraine is moving forward on all the issues, deadlines need to be realistic. The next tranche of the IMF loan to Ukraine was scheduled for last November, but has been delayed due to a lack of progress on necessary reforms. A return to the abnormal normal. That's how OSCE spokesperson Alexander Haug described the war in Ukraine's east this week. The de-escalation became noticeable over the weekend and continued through the week. Heavy shelling decreased by 75% from the previous week, but it continued. And in the Mariupol area, it increased by 20%. During the week, one Ukrainian soldier was killed and seven were wounded. And here's a feature interview with Katerina Yushchenko and Anastasia Medved on developments in community activism and NGOs in Ukraine. I have two guests in the studio with me today. One is Katerina Yushchenko, chairperson of Ukraine 3000 Foundation. Through her work in this foundation, the foundation addresses issues like healthcare for children, education, the homeless and orphaned children, and integrating the handicapped into society. To most Ukrainians, she needs no introduction because she's well known as she's First Lady of Ukraine from 2005 to 2010. Today, she continues her work in the charity sector. Our other guest is Anastasia Medved. She's the public relations specialist for Crimea SOS, which is a new NGO that has appeared since the Maidan, working for and with people displaced from Crimea due to the Russian annexation. Now, a common opinion one hears in Ukraine these days is that the Maidan gave birth to a great deal of community activism, that there was this surge of volunteering. Now, if you look more closely at the activities of NGOs and charities and community organizations, you realize this did not come about just at that time. But really, Ukrainians had been gaining experience in self-organizing for many years in the community. If you go back further, the Soviet government really did not encourage community initiatives because, you know, authoritarian state, the state had to control everything. So with the beginnings of independence, Ukrainians rediscovered working in community organizations and serving the community where help is needed, but, you know, the government really just can't provide. So I'll start with Katerina Yushchenko. You came to work in Ukraine in the early 1990s. Given that people didn't really have experience in volunteering or taking community initiatives, how did you find starting community activism in those years? What were Ukrainians' attitudes to volunteering or donating?
Thank you, Oksana. As you and I both came from countries where volunteerism, charity was very much a part of society, it was a little bit difficult coming to Ukraine, where not only was charity looked down upon, it was actually forbidden. During the Soviet period in the 30s, priests could be fined, churches could be closed down because of their activism in social politics. And as a result, everything was top down as bottom up, as you said. But we came from a society where more than 90% of people actually were involved with activism. You and I both came from Canada, the United States, where it was expected that you would volunteer, you would work. It was the only way to actually become active in your society. It was very much a part of your entering college. You had to show that you had been active. And so it was difficult coming to Ukraine, where it was any kind of charitable activity was looked upon as suspect. People thought if you tried to raise money, if you tried to help, there was something possibly illicit about it. It was something possibly that you were trying to make money. I would get questions, why are you doing this? Are you doing this because you're making money? Who's paying you? And when you'd say, not only does someone not pay me, that on the just the opposite, I would actually contribute my own money, they thought it was strange because they had not been used to bottom-up initiatives. They were used to top-down initiatives. And I think it's very important that over the years that has changed.
So what did motivate you? What needs did you see in society that drew you to this work?
Well, in the 90s, there were so many needs that wherever you touched needed to be changed. I helped, for example, from the very end of it, I helped start the first animal shelter for Ukraine because it was just absolutely unexpected for me to see thousands of animals on the street. So I started with that. Then I immediately changed to orphans. And then I worked with education. I worked with many different areas. But what was very strange is that people were very, very, you would come into an orphanage and they would be wondering, what do you want to gain from this if you're coming to this orphanage to help? What do you want to see? They would close the orphanage and not let you in. But meanwhile, there was a great change and many more organizations were coming in and you were seeing it change right before your eyes.
So you ended up starting Ukraine 3000. What did this organization end up doing? What are you doing today?
You know, when we saw in the 90s that people were distrustful, I think that in the 2000s, we started seeing people starting to be to adopt Western principles. Western principles of transparency, of systemic change rather than one-off change, not giving just to a local person, but trying to give that same money to affect many people's lives. As they said, giving the fishing rod rather than just giving money to the fishermen. And I think we started seeing large funds being created, some of them with truly dishonest money, but at least it was being oriented, just like in the United States and Canada and many other countries. They were, the big oligarchs started orienting toward being more effective and seeing actual money, that the money was being used for more systemic change. We saw transparency. We saw the emphasis on greater impact for every Kopeck, every hryvnia that was donated. We started the foundation because we felt very strongly that the change needed to go bottom up and not top down. And all our programs, they were in education, in health, in arts, history, language, it was all oriented toward getting citizens involved in society. For example, we created an organization called Dobro Pochinaye za tebe, Good Begins With You, when we encouraged children in schools to become active in areas, not because their teachers told them, but because they themselves wanted to work in the environment or work in helping orphans or work in helping old people. And we encouraged them, mentored them. We tried to get them involved. In the medical area, whenever we started a program to help hospitals, we made sure that it involved the entire community, that they became involved. When we started the program, Building a Hospital for the Future, we encouraged crowdfunding. We were one of the first to get involved in that because it was not only, we got very little from the crowd, but the whole point was to get people involved and have a stake in change in the medical system of Ukraine.
Have you noticed that there's qualitative changes in the type of organizations that are the new ones that had appeared around this time of the Maidan?
Absolutely. I think what we saw when the Maidan started was much of the, you could say, doubt, much of the concern that there was dishonesty suddenly disappeared and people started to become active and everyone volunteered anything they could. We actually saw this in 2004 during the Orange Revolution. Restaurants helping where they could, doctors helping where they could. And then with the Maidan in 2013-14, people starting to do what they can. Everybody did everything they could.
They could see that the need was immediate.
They saw the need and it was immediate. Since then, it's been interesting because we see people becoming more specialized, and that's a very effective thing. Those who can provide transportation, provide transportation. Those who can provide training, provide training. Those who can do something else can do that. And I think that that's very, very useful. Some of it has fallen back and some people are concerned, but I think that the Ukrainian people are always ready to respond to needs as they come up. And that is a very exciting thing. And I think right now we are setting an example for all of Europe and indeed even for the United States of citizen activism.
That's a very positive note there to finish on. But so if I can now turn to Anastasia. I noticed that with the events of Maidan in 2014 and the annexation of Crimea and the provocations and then the armed conflict in the Donbass, I think Ukraine was confronted with a crisis. And the government was not managing with national defense. The army was not ready. The ministries were not coping with the floods of refugees coming from the Donbass or Crimea. So you had, you know, volunteers getting together, filling in the gap, defending their country in the east, feeding, clothing the army, etc., and helping refugees. So Crimea SOS is one of these organizations that was born at this time, and it's an organization that had to grow up very fast, in fact. So Anastasia, I'd like to ask you a bit about how Crimea SOS was founded. How did it all start?
Good afternoon. I would make first little remark. We help not only internally displaced persons from Crimea, but both from eastern Ukraine. And how it all started, it was in 2014, on February 27, the first day of annexation. Three friends, Crimean Tatars, Crimeans, who lived already for some time on the mainland Ukraine, just gathered together to think, what can we do? They saw that the administrative buildings are captured and the annexation is going on. That's why they created just a Facebook page, something that they could do really fast, and started gathering news and facts about the annexation. And it was surprising how fast a really huge network of volunteers was built. Lots of people in Crimea, they were providing information to us about Russian militaries, about base capturing and everything. They were moving across the peninsula and giving us this information. And on the mainland Ukraine and also in different countries, in states, for example, we had lots of volunteers who were checking, verifying this information and posting in 24 hours a day. And that is why, due to this volunteer great impact, Crimea SOS became just the first source of news about Crimea during the first months of annexation. But really fast, we have become not only a news feed, but also an assistance center, because Crimean families start to move out of the peninsula. And also we started gathering help on the mainland Ukraine to send to our soldiers in peninsula. So it's all become to work.
It became a meeting point
for
people wanting to help somehow.
Yes, our guys just bought a few cell phones and they were answering calls for assistance, offers with help, like 24 hours a day. And it was really surprising.
So how did it get then from that kind of very spontaneous kind of organization to a registered community organization?
I would say that we became some kind of systematic organization in June 2014, when we has become the partners of UN Refugee Agency. And this happened because internally displaced persons from Crimea has started to move here on the mainland Ukraine. And also the conflict on eastern Ukraine has brought up. And no one was waiting for that, but there was a huge flee of people who needed help. They needed accommodation. They need psychological help a lot, especially, for example, Crimean Tatars who were sent from peninsula like it was during the deportation in like 1944. It was a huge tragedy for them. And we understood that those network of volunteers that we have is great, but it's not enough, because today you have volunteers, tomorrow you don't, but there are still people who need help. That is why we started looking for some funds to establish like team members and everything and help people systematically. And really, we thought that this whole thing with our organization will last till the end of 2014. Really believed. So did the people who asked
for
help.
You were hoping that wouldn't be necessary anymore.
Exactly. Mm. We were like 100% sure about that. But as we see, it's almost 3 years that Crimea SOS has worked, and still the necessity of our work hasn't reduced.
Do you still get people volunteering? I mean, the situation has, I guess, stabilized, we could say, although not resolved. So do you still get people turning to you to volunteer, making donations?
I would say that firstly for us, for people who work with this thing from inside, the situation isn't stable at all, because we see like all this outrageous shelling in Avdiivka. We monitor all the human rights violation in Crimea, and the situation is not getting better or more stable. It's just getting worse, and we see this from inside. And it is, of course, an issue that people are tired today. They're tired of all the problems, of all the needers. There are so many variety of things that you could donate for, and it's really hard to motivate people to give something, in this situation. But still, we have lots of volunteers in our offices all across the country. These are the people that don't go like for the experience or something. They even don't mostly have the idea what they want to do. They just see our organization. They have some kind of trust to what we do. They see the results and they want to be a part of it.
Mm. That's good to hear that there's still this interaction with the community.
And by the way, about all these donation things, we see like in 2014, people were heavily donating to the army, to the internally displaced persons and everything. Today, it's not happening. But still, we see that it's the challenge for NGOs to find the new ways and approaches for donating. And I have a great example of that. In 2016, in autumn, we were gathering money for the bus for elderly people. It's the hospice. It's located near the Kyiv, and like 30 elderly people who don't have families, they live in there and they are taken care of. And they needed a transport to go to the hospital to gather aid, products and everything. And we started a crowdfunding campaign gathering 100,000 hryvnias. It was a really huge number. And we didn't start to post some sad stories about that people and everything. We've launched a network of so-called kind events where we gathered people to do yoga, to read poems, to watch movies, like everything, but not connected with like the problem or some sad and painful stuff. Mm-hmm. So these are just things that people liked to do. And with instead of the ticket, they donate. Mm-hmm. And we gathered the sum of money. We gathered 112,000 hryvnias.
Excellent.
It was really crazy.
Mm. So I guess it's a constant process of evolution, of finding ways that you can grow. There are many other community organizations and community activism that we could talk about. What these organizations all have in common is that I find people say, like, why doesn't the government fix this? It's people who say, what can I do about this? And that's very encouraging to see this in Ukrainian society. So thank you very much for this conversation, for sharing your stories, Anastasia Medvedev and Katarina Yushchenko. Thank you for this glimpse into your life, into the lives of your organizations. Culture and music. A group of Ukrainian musicians from various bands and genres got together and are working on some new songs for the army. Some of them play rock, some folk, but are all very successful musicians. Taras Chubai, Foma, Taras Kompanichenko, Ivan Lenyo, Sashko Polozhinsky, Oleg Skrepka are the names. This past week, photos of their recording session began appearing on Facebook and in Ukrainian media, taken in Chubai's home studio, which has the latest high-tech recording equipment in a beautiful country home built of logs. Another interesting event on the cultural scene is an unusual exhibition. Two journalism students from Mariupol University are preparing an exhibit of love letters that were written but never sent. It will be called Pro kochanya movchate, being silent about love. These are real letters. Some of them have photos, some from the war zone. The organizers are Patricia Havorkian and Anastasia Berdina. We'll keep you posted about the date and location of the opening. And this week's song for you is Ebedi Sevgi, sung in Crimean Tatar by Alfa Leo. It means eternal love. Next week for a new episode. And in the meantime, we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. I'm Oksana Smerichuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.